All right. So those that don't have a seat, you're welcome to take a seat. Our panel is all along here, just so you have a clear perspective on folks that are going to be speaking at the beginning. So I'm Mike with this space, the 2640 space, and with Occupy Baltimore and everything around it. And what motivated this event tonight is that tomorrow we have our second month anniversary of having taken the plaza on October 4th. And we here in Baltimore and occupies all over the country are kind of still continuing to face outwards, but turning inwards and trying to understand what it is that we've done so far. And you can see this in what the essays that are being published all over the place. We're starting to add depth to our movement and to our movement thought. And it's a really ripe time to do it. You know, there's been that first phase, the really ecstatic phase, and then there's been a good bit of repression. And as folks are now kind of approaching winter and collecting our thoughts, you see events like this and essays being published all over the place. So welcome. Just so you know, we're here while Occupy Baltimore is under constant threat of eviction. That threat has been escalated a little bit over the last couple days. So at any moment when we most or least expected it might happen. And then we'll be forced to deal with what that means as well. But in that light, and with a bunch of upcoming events that are all on your chairs, which you all should take a look at, I'm going to pass the microphone to Sergio, and then Joy, and Casey, and Molly, Lester, Anne-Marie, and John. All to reflect on it. We're going to limit the comments to 5 minutes apiece, and then have a little bit of comment back and forth between the panelists, all of whom relate to Occupy Baltimore and the Occupy movement in one way or another, as allies, as participants, as analysts. And then we're going to open up the floor. I'm going to get a feel from people at the end of this discussion amongst the panelists, whether we want to break up into small groups and talk about thematic areas of things that we've touched upon in the discussion and try and deepen it and then come back and kind of report back so folks hear what's going on, or if we want to just do a two-minute collective comments until we run out of time or energy. So we'll figure that out after the panelist stuff is done. And here's Sergio.
Hey, all. All right, so thanks for coming to this talk. I think it's a really important anniversary of something that hasn't happened before that is now going on. It's just really inspiring, and that's why we're all here to learn a little bit more about how we keep that going. I'm going to be talking a little bit about Occupy from the point of view of an ally to Occupy Baltimore. I've been a part of it individually from the beginning planning meetings that happened here at 2640 to, you know, being there for the first week of going to the GAs and stuff. But for the most part, I've been involved with Occupy Baltimore through two organizations that I'm a part of. One of which is Civilian Soldier Alliance. It's an ally organization of civilians that work directly with veterans and active duty members around the country that we actually got started here in Baltimore last February. And basically, the model that we have of organizing is very similar to Occupy in terms of focused on non-hierarchical consensus on a national level and building power through having a campaign in which we challenge the establishment. In terms of our focus, it's to help build the GI resistance movement. And so what drives us in terms of the work that we do is, apart from working directly in solidarity with veterans and active duty members, we focus on a campaign to help us develop the skills and develop ourselves as leaders. It's one of the parallels that we see with Occupy around the country that we think is worth highlighting is just the strength of Occupy Baltimore and Occupy in general. It's that it creates an opportunity where everyone that comes in is recognized as having the potential to be a leader in the movement. And that's something that's been missing for a good chunk of time, and that now it's very, very apparent just how much power there is by doing that, by really conceding and to each other that, you know, that level of trust and of responsibility. And so, you know, we've been doing stuff like we're having a teaching there next week. We've been having members from Iraq Veterans Against the War come to Occupy Baltimore to come talk, and also to different Occupy sites around the country. And then the other organization that I've been a part of, I've been an ally for many years, is United Workers, many folks here know, that got started in Baltimore in 2002. It's started by homeless day laborers that have been that started organizing for a living wage campaign down at Camden Yards. And after they won that, they've continued to build a movement in poverty by actually working on a campaign at the Inner Harbor, right next to McKeldin Square. So what's been happening there has been really crucial and been really encouraging for United Workers in terms of showing that solidarity that's happening from folks at Occupy and from Baltimore in general, and to give us this space in which we can continue to, not just our campaign, but to really talk about the economic human rights that are being trampled throughout the city and throughout the country, and not just talk about it, but have everyone in the city actually, you know, prove that we can stand up to actually challenge this in very concrete ways and very effective ways. For example, we've been doing marches alongside them, and also what Occupy's been doing with United Workers with another BDC as possible. We've been finding very specific ways in which we're challenging this, engaging in dialogues while also engaging in civil disobedience. And those two organizations, what they elicited in me that I think I see in Occupy, and it's very clear it's happening, but I just want to make it really explicit, is, and I've already said it, but I just want to repeat it again, it's just the importance of creating a space where everyone has equal weight and equal responsibility. And in terms of what's been going on at the site, it's been one where, you know, people step in. One thing that I guess I would like to highlight from that, and it's just that we don't lose sight of that, because of, there's just so many examples of it that's been happening in Occupy Baltimore, like where initially there'd be some divisions or some confrontations between folks have, you know, see organizing this way or want to just engage in these forms of action or these forms of how we do outreach, et cetera. And it led to tension. But now when I talk to folks that have been down at the site for the past couple months, that tension seems to be very clearly dissipating because we're learning from one another. It's not just an issue that folks have things that we disagree on, it's by having these different aspects and giving up space for them, we're actually able to really build up more power. And so I just want to highlight that as we continue moving forward, that we don't lose sight of the importance of that. And then also just in terms of the name itself, Occupy, it's that form of action that we take on, that's been part of the new thing. Folks have been organizing for years, been engaging in forms of direct action, but the beauty of Occupy is its simplicity and also the tactic that it does, where by taking up a space, we very clearly and continuously show that we're standing not just for something, but we're directly challenging. We're engaging in a form of constant civil disobedience, and so that's how we've been able to continue to build up our pressure and to also show that we're very serious, that we're very committed. And as different Occupy sites around the country have been, you know, there tends to be an ebb and flow about what places we're staying at and what park. I would just want to again stress what a lot of folks in this room already know, but just as we move forward, that you can't evict an idea, you can't challenge that aspect of it. So for us to not lose sight, I think once as fights continue to happen at different Occupy sites, we all need to be a part of them, but to never lose also sight of the fact that, like, this is just one way in which we manifested our commitment to constantly challenging the establishment and to building power. So as we transition, if we do transition into other places, as long as we don't lose sight of the fact that we need to continue that form of actual challenging stuff, that's pretty much how we're going to continue to build power. And that's pretty much in a nutshell what I'm going to say.
Hello, everybody. I'm Joy. I am an occupier as well as a person that works offsite. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about what I've been doing on-site and what I would like to do in the future and what I would like to see us as Occupy Baltimore kind of do in the future. So currently, I am on Outreach Direct Action, and I'm very fortunate to work on that working group. What we've been able to do is work with interfaith, to work with colleges, to work with a lot of people, because I feel like one way we need to move forward is to get it out to communities. It's very good that we are down at McKeldin occupying tents, but I feel like we need to kind of bridge that gap and take it to people. I don't think that we need to be limited by the space in which we're occupying currently. I know there's more people on this panel from another BDC as possible, but I would like us to focus a little bit more on the infrastructures that are around, such as the Baltimore Development Corporation, but I'm sure Casey and John will talk about that. Also, what I'm interested in working in is with interconnected working groups. We've been talking with different occupies across the nation about possibly doing actions on a larger scale, and I'd like to see us do that as well. I guess a little bit more about what's happening at the site currently. Currently, we're very small, but we're very strong, and I'm very happy to be a part of that. Right now, we are low in numbers. We're about 50 people. But one of the beauties of being down there occupying, or the people that help that don't sleep down there, is that we've managed to kind of sustain ourselves being down there so far. And I think that is something that we need to look forward to as we move on, whether we get evicted, we move to, there's talk of possibly having an office space, is that we keep that idea of community here. At whatever space we go to. Foreclosures. I know a lot of people are talking about foreclosures. There's a lot of talk out in the space, in the Occupy spaces around the country and the globe about foreclosures. And I got word from the housing department that in Maryland, come spring, they will be moving hundreds out of a back catalog from the housing department. They will be foreclosing hundreds of people a month. So that's another thing I would like to see us move forward to. There was one thing that was on the Facebook and that Mike told me about as far as like what to talk about, and I'd like to move forward with that to keep it short. Good. Okay, cool. I would like us, one of the questions was, how do we move forward during an election year? And this is something that I think is very important to keep in mind, that we are coming at a very important part in history, where we have a lot of people that are very contentious about not only the election, but the movement, and that we need to stay nonpartisan. And I would like to stay nonpartisan. And that we look to approach all sides of the conversation. And we have a lot of power as far as how we gauge the conversation. And I'd like to see us do that as well. And that's all my notes. I thought I had way more notes to talk about. But yeah, that's it.
Hi, my name is Casey. I am a part of Occupy Baltimore and another BDC as possible. I got involved with Occupy Baltimore here 2 months ago, the initial couple meetings that we had here that were really inspiring, a couple hundred people coming together and just brainstorming all these ideas of what we might be able to do. And basically, with the idea of where do we go from here, I think we have this really cool phenomenon that is Occupy, that is, you know, sprung up all over the country and all over the world, and it's been really inspiring, and you know, it's gotten all this attention, and it's created a lot of momentum. And it initially began with the idea of occupying a public space, and I think that there's a lot of importance to that, to be right out there where everyone can see, a daily reminder of, you know, what all these people have come together for. And I think, though, as things transition, as, you know, we're coming into winter, as different Occupy encampments across the country are being evicted, I think that we can build off of the momentum which occupying a public space has created and move forward with it and kind of just evolve what Occupy means. I think we can use the opportunity to maybe continue to occupy public space, whether it's 24 hours or if it's just on a daily basis as a meeting place where people can come together and talk about things and hold general assemblies or start actions, start rallies, or, you know, if it works out to actually continue being there, but have what Occupy means, really, really grow that and evolve the movement to have, you know, occupying different spaces, occupying temporarily, like maybe doing 24-hour occupation somewhere, you know, occupying the BDC as we did by holding a public meeting just a few weeks ago in front of the Baltimore Development Corporation. You know, that's another way of occupying and having like a bunch of different projects all take on the idea of Occupy and, you know, be it, you know, anybody can be a part of Occupy Baltimore. So if you want to do something, you know, go occupy your school, go occupy whatever you want to work on. Yeah, your grocery store. And I think one thing that it's really important that we need to be thinking a lot about as we move forward. You know, we've been doing this for 2 months now, and there's a whole lot of momentum right in the beginning. We had hundreds of people involved, and there's been a lot of people that we don't see coming out anymore, but then there's also been a lot of new people, you know, people that come out when needed. But I think we need to continue to think about and discuss how to get people not only reinvested, but get new people involved. And I think by the idea of occupying in all these different ways, you know, transitioning into a movement that has all these different arms, that can be a way of starting to do that. But I think also there's a huge emphasis that needs to be placed on just sort of linking movements, working with other groups in the city that have been doing this stuff all along, and other groups that maybe haven't been doing this but want to. And we need to, you know, continue to work with people that know how to do outreach and just continue this dialogue so that we can build this huge network of support that builds off of the momentum that we have from this thing, which is Occupy Baltimore, that has been created. And one of the cool ways I think we can take this, and I'll try to be really brief here, is just to focus on development. We had, as I mentioned, this really successful event on November 7th with the Baltimore Development Corporation. And I think that we have this rare opportunity that because of what Occupy is and that we kind of grew out of this group that kind of formed from Occupy, we were able to actually get President Brody of the BDC to come down and meet with us, you know, to meet with us outside in front. And I think that that's a success. You know, that means they're paying attention, that we have some sort of significance, you know, here, that they're paying attention. And I think we need to keep going with that. You know, we can use this momentum and this power that has been created and start challenging the current systems that are out there. You know, begin talking with, an example of the BDC, talking about how do we get living wages, you know, how the idea of participatory budgeting, you know, community involvement in the planning process. Let's start talking about these things. Let's get those ideas out there and try and make them a reality. And I really just think the most important thing that can come out of all of this as we move forward is just to really keep getting people thinking and getting people talking and just working together with all these different groups in Baltimore. So
good evening, everybody. I just am so happy to be here 2 months after the occupation began here in Baltimore and to see this many people still involved and still interested. And it just makes me so happy that this movement has begun and that we're all a part of it in whatever way we are a part of it. I am a member of Good Jobs, Better Baltimore. We are an ally organization. We've been working closely with Occupy, I think, from the get-go, have had a couple sort of joint actions. And our organizing is really helped by the efforts of people here with Occupy. And I think we are a very natural ally. Our mission as Good Jobs, Better Baltimore is to help get people organized here in Baltimore to stand up against corporations, against policies that really help, you know, the power structure and not the individuals that live in this country, in this city. We are closely affiliated with the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, and work here in Baltimore with the United Healthcare Workers and with 32BJ, which is the janitors and service security guard employees union. I want to say first that the physical space that Occupy takes up with the encampments across the country is incredibly important and beautiful, and I think it is the sort of tangible manifestation of the bigger thing here, which is the idea, the ideological space that the Occupy movement has taken. And I think that this movement has been incredibly successful in doing something that I know the labor movement has wanted to do for a long time, which is change the dialogue, you know, change the dialogue in this country to reflect the needs of people. And we're far. We have a lot of work to do. I think we all know that. But here we are, so that's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to say. I think it's so important for this movement, coming from an ally perspective, that it continues and that people really, you know, just see this as the beginning and see this as the starting point from which we're going to move forward and which we're going to continue to organize and become better organized, because it's a learning process. And that this movement will continue to incorporate new people, new faces, new bodies, organizations that already exist that are interested and may not know how to plug in, but that people are continually thinking about that as this movement goes forward, and that we all congratulate ourselves for how far we've come just with the dialogue we have been able to spark, because it's a pretty phenomenal thing. Another thing I want to speak to just briefly is, you know, sort of the obvious, which is the process that takes place in the General Assembly and in other forums where people are talking about the Occupy movement. And this is the model of participatory democracy, which I think is incredibly important to the movement in general, and looking at what democracy means. And for people that are involved in the labor movement, you know, that is democracy in the workplace, and that of course is pivotal to everything that we do in trying to organize workers. But obviously, you know, the workplace is just a small portion of, well, maybe not so small, but a portion of what needs to happen in this movement generally. So yeah, I mean, just to reiterate, I mean, I hope everyone still feels the importance of what is happening here and now, and continues to work as hard as they can, and continues to reach out to allies, and continues to work closely with the labor movement and other, you know, community organizations here in Baltimore that have, you know, wide scope and individual neighborhoods and existing social movements that are already underway here in Baltimore.
First, I'd like to ask everybody to do me a favor. If you haven't done so already, please turn your cell phone to vibrate, because if I hear a ring, I'm going to talk about you and stop what I'm saying. My name is Lester Spence. I am a professor at Johns Hopkins University. I'm a political scientist. What I'm going to do is talk briefly and play kind of the role of the critic, even as I am a supporter of Occupy and what it represents. I think there are a few challenges and a few opportunities that that Occupy has. As far as the space, if you think about Occupy as an attempt to retake the public, part of that is about changing the dialogue. Part of that is about changing material policies, and part of it is just about increasing access to space. I think that there is a very clear reason as to why Occupy began as a physical movement. Right, why it began as an attempt to take space. But here's the challenge. So I am the product of, to the extent I was involved in activism, I was primarily involved in student activism. In the early 80s at the University of Michigan, there is an organization or movement designed to get University of Michigan to divest itself from South Africa, the Free South Africa Coordinating Committee. And one of the tactics they used to call the relationship between the University of Michigan and South Africa into question was they built shanties on our physical space, on the place that students had to walk to every day to campus. You could not go to your class, you couldn't go to the library, you couldn't go to drink beer without seeing these shanties, right? And it had an effect for a certain period of time. But after a while, what happened, right? People got used to seeing the physical object, and seeing the physical object was detached from a political critique, right? So after a moment, it was just like, oh, there is just these buildings. So by focusing solely on the capture of space, and by not thinking of that thing as temporary, you run the risk of that space just being neutered. And all of a sudden, the people who are driving by, it's like, oh, yeah, those are those 99% guys. Yeah. They beep the horn and go on. There are no politics attached to that, right? The second thing that's kind of related to that is we run the risk of reifying and crystallizing the Occupy movement. The thing that I thought was really unique about Occupy, the thing that I thought that made it incredibly 21st century, was the fact that it had no barriers to entry, right? It had absolutely no barriers to entry. It didn't matter what your capacity was as far as leadership, whether you knew Robert's Rules of Order. It didn't matter what your politics was. It didn't matter what your race, your sexuality, your gender. It didn't matter, right? Technically, at the outset, somebody could have started an organization on the east side of Baltimore, called it Occupy Baltimore, right? And nobody would have been able to say anything, right? So I saw this as an idea that had the potential to proliferate in as many spaces as Baltimore required, right? So whether it's people who wanted same-sex rights to be Occupy Baltimore, whether it's people who wanted to save their homes to be Occupy Baltimore, whether it's black kids who wanted to end the school-to-prison pipeline, they could have been Occupy Baltimore. And just imagine the mayor or other political forces trying to deal with a swarm, right? And what I see is I see that moment slipping away. Right. So, for example, if you go to the website, the Occupy Baltimore website, it says, we meet at McKeldin Square every day at 8 p.m. At that point, that means Occupy Baltimore really is just a thing. And at that point, the critiques that people that I've been fighting against, critiques by people of color in particular saying, like, listen, Occupy doesn't meet our needs. Occupy is very, very specific racially. At that point, the pushback that I would give is meaningless. Right, so what I would say is, like, listen, you could start your own Occupy Baltimore, right? But at that point, you can't. So that's the third thing. The final thing with 40 seconds left, and this is more of a national critique. It seems as if repression has really increased support for Occupy. Not necessarily here, because there hasn't been a great deal of repression, but in other places. The danger with using police repression in order to build support is that it requires violence and takes us away from the type of things we're doing, right? So Martin Luther King Jr.'s greatest loss was at Albany, Georgia, because the police came and they arrested him, but they didn't use nonviolent tactics. I mean, they used nonviolent tactics against him. But because the movement was kind of sort of based on this idea of people attacking them, It fell short. Finally, and now I'm over time. To the extent we deal with politics or with something, we have to really focus on people's material reality. It's one thing that it's all good to have discussions to build dialogue, yes, but we have to deal with people's material reality. I think with the weather changing, the best thing to do and the best way to kind of recapture that proliferative dynamic is to begin helping people save their homes. On that note, thank you very much.
Wow. I'm Anne Marie. I'm part of Occupy Baltimore. And I'm going to just focus a little bit more on the physical occupation itself and the philosophy behind that and how it's kind of grown. In starting, it was a really good statement to have this occupation has been, oh, louder, oh my goodness. In the beginning, it was a really good statement to have this physical occupation that people had to see every single day, and you have to think about it, and it's part of your conversation, part of your dialogue with someone every day. But as the time goes on, you know, that dialogue gets a little stale. And as this gentleman was saying, you kind of grow old of the honking on the horns every day. And you say, oh yeah, it's still there, and what's it doing? Now I think that it's a brilliant thing, and it's brilliant how so many people have come together, so many different people, different walks of life have come together under this common purpose of being unhappy with the way things are. But I do think that the occupation is in itself is a starting point. I think that it is a starting point to growing a vaster movement, a movement that will. I'd like to see it taking one piece of, say, a neighborhood or a city, and growing and spreading that throughout the country. I think through that. But I don't. I cannot read my writing. I'm going to pass this over.
All right. So hi, I'm John. And I'm speaking here as somebody who's been peripherally involved with some aspects of Occupy Baltimore, been involved with some of the anti-development stuff that's come out of it, involved with this space, involved with a lot of other projects. I'm looking around the room. I'm seeing a lot of people who I know have put in hours and hours and days and weeks and months into keeping that occupation alive down there. And I just want to thank them, first of all, because they've done an amazing job. And I want to throw out four questions here. We'll see if I can get through them really quickly. The first, and two of these questions are not entirely mine, two of these questions are. The first is, what do we do about systemic crisis? Right? The reason Occupy has taken off is not just because people hit on a right idea or because of branding. Right? It's because we're in a really, really bad state. Right? There are a lot of people suffering. And that's going to continue, and that's going to get worse. Right? When you look at what's going on, things are going downhill. Things are going downhill for very, very big reasons that are very hard to correct with traditional mechanisms. So how do we respond to that? And how do we respond to that specifically when that systemic crisis is lumpy, right? When it affects different people, different populations differently. You look at the labor statistics this month, right? Unemployment, right, has gone down, right? But if you look at unemployment in African-American communities, it's gone up, right? So how do we keep together the 99% when we have different rates of crisis? And different kinds of deals being cut to divide us? That's one question. Second question has to do with tactics, right? A lot of you probably know Gramsci's distinction between a war of position and a war of maneuver, right? This is Carl Davidson was talking a little bit about this last night, or two nights ago. But basically, on the one hand, you're fighting over war of position, you're fighting over dialogue, you're fighting over consensus, ideology, you're fighting for what counts as common sense. On the other hand, you have war of maneuver. You're out, you're fighting the state, you're out in the field actually waging a military struggle. Thing is, we're doing both here. We have a very, very tiny war of maneuver, right? If McKeldin looks like a military camp, it's because it is. We are holding territory against the state. We have big military tents. Our weapons may be books, right, and teach-ins and long consensus meetings, but nevertheless, we are trying to fight that on that level. And then the larger question is, how do we change the dialogue? Now, it seems to me that those two things are intimately connected. We would not have changed the dialogue if we hadn't occupied the space, and maybe even vice versa. And what I think is a challenge for us, and the question I have is, how do we push that forward? How do we expand those spheres of contestation, right? When the occupation tactic no longer works, what's the next step? How do we keep changing the dialogue? And in order to change the dialogue, how do we raise the stakes out in the field, as it were, on the ground? Third question, education. I come out of the anti-globalization movement, right? The anti-globalization movement had a clear target, right? The WTO, the IMF, the World Bank. If you looked at how the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO worked, right, you started to get a really good education about what the mechanics of global capitalism were, how neoliberalism worked, how propaganda worked, right? There was a whole process by which people brought themselves up to be educated about things through that target. The 1% is a really bad target. You'll learn a lot about specific acts of corruption. You'll learn a lot about specific things that happen with the bailout. You don't learn a lot about capitalism, right? In some ways, the 99%, right, it gathers a lot of people together, but it also, you can throw a lot under that. It hides a lot of things. It hides a lot of divisions. And so I feel that in this era of, you know, very, very hyper internet organizing, where people are plugging in, plugging out whenever they choose, there's this filter bubble problem, right? Where we're not all engaging on a common theoretical political analysis and program. And I think that's a challenge. What does a pedagogy appropriate to the 99% in this massively networked age look like? One final question has to do with, I'll just put it this way, where is the social forum? All right. If you've been paying attention to activism over the past couple of years, for the past like half decade, there's been an amazing process of grassroots mobilization and self-organization in the U.S. social forum, right? It's tremendous, tremendous sophisticated politics being developed, tremendous networks being, being constructed, largely absent from this recent wave of actions, right? So how many people here have heard of Occupy Wall Street? Okay, how many people here have heard of Bloombergville? Bloombergville. Not as many, right? And the point here is that there was this, you know, there were these community organizations that were laying the groundwork and laying the groundwork of the critique and the tactics. Those voices haven't been present as this mobilization has gone, you know, nova, right? Do those voices come back? Do those structures come back into the discussion, into the action? When the spring thaws out, does everybody who's gotten politicized in the past 3 months, you know, join back up with all the people who have been fighting for 40 years to lay really, really solid connections and communities? That's what I want to see happen. I don't know if it's going to. And that's the question and the challenge that I'll end on.
So, hey, so right now, for a minute, if folks want to talk, bring up points that other folks brought up, there's some really rich stuff. If folks don't have anything to say, I'll start talking. So somebody grab the mic.
Okay, I'll speak a little bit more now. I wanted to address Lester Spence. I really appreciate and value your criticisms because we need that. And it opened my eyes a little bit. As far as like addressing lack of inclusion, I think that it's worth noting that we haven't done a good job, not just locally, but also nationally, including not just racially different, but also faith communities and other communities throughout the nation. And what we can do, I think a solution to that would be to go into those communities as opposed to expecting them to come to us. We have this notion, and I think it's a little bit arrogant, that we think that they're all going to come down to McKeldin. They're all going to come, well, they probably all will come to Zuccotti, but they're all going to come to their local occupies when we actually need to come to them, to their doors, to their churches, to their schools, maybe help clean up in their area. I know these are like lighter suggestions, but we need to know that they are the 99%, if that's the branding we're going with, and to include them and to be friendly to them and not to say, where were you at McKeldin? I didn't see you at the GA. Because that's something that I think even people down on site know now, is that it's really difficult to sleep in a tent, especially as it gets cold. It's really difficult to sit through a 4-hour GA. It's really difficult to come down to McKeldin itself. Parking alone is a really big issue. I say these sort of mundane things because now we're realizing it, and maybe that's something that should have been planned, but I don't want to talk about should, coulda, woulda. I just want to move forward and kind of launch ourselves into the communities. We can go as far as Howard County, but I would love for us to even start working around McKeldin and move forward.
I also just really quick want to touch off of what folks were talking about in terms of addressing the needs, and you know, like the example you were giving about going out to communities and stuff. Like, it's also important to recognize that a lot of these communities have not only like need us to go to them, like they've been doing amazing work in their neighborhoods for a very, very long time, and really, you know, building these. I guess maybe for a lot of folks in this room, it feels like they're isolated, but in terms of their own communities, it's not. Where they know that they're what their needs are, and they're speaking to them, but they don't know how to. They just don't actually know individual people that are part of what Occupy Baltimore or other folks. So they don't see they also don't see the need to really connect with it. So I think it's important to recognize that what's happened 2 months ago is brand new. But in terms of standing up, in terms of bettering our environment, that there's nothing new about that. And so just for us to be aware of not just the need to reach out to folks, but also to do it with this sense of like, oh, hey, we don't know everything. A lot of folks in their communities do too. I mean, I do actually know what's going on. Like, what are they doing? How is it that we can engage in a conversation so we can address each other's needs? And then that focus too of like, really it needs to be driven by needs. In terms of Occupy, what I see it, like, why was it everyone just like really jumped on it? It's a lot of different reasons. We're touching on some of them. I think that part of it was just like, we just like collectively as a nation had this strong need to show our outrage and just immediately because we've you know, a lot of us have been swallowing this for decades, if not centuries. A lot of folks over the course of economic crisis have had to swallow it very recently and haven't been used to it, while a lot of other folks have. And so so I think that was a need that was met in terms of like this is a way in which we're visible, in which we're upset, in which we're standing up for something. But those aren't the only needs. They're very material needs, you know, and we need to be thinking about how is it that we speak to that, and that we not only speak to that, but that we address that. For example, in terms of organizing within the military, you know, like we, the military is you look at internal polls for folks that are actually serving. They're until recently, for the past several years, they were actually more against the occupations than the general public was. And despite that, there has been this strong upsurge of military resistance, and of connecting with folks in the anti-war movement because they felt that their needs weren't being met. They weren't talking about it. It was this talk about like, well, yeah, they need to be working with us on the anti-war side so that we can, you know, end this stuff. And they need to get on. So we need just, if we talk to them and tell them to come to our protest, then they will, and then it'll all be set. And that really wasn't happening. And it wasn't, what helped us out was just that realizing that they had needs, and by speaking to the needs in their community in terms of the fact that 1 in 3 women in the military is suffering some form of sexual trauma, 20% of the military, by the Pentagon's own figure, has some form of trauma, post-traumatic stress, TBI, et cetera. By doing all that and speaking to that, we've been able to bring in a lot more folks that are serving to become more vocal about their resistance, to become further organized. And I think that's something for us to think about in terms of Occupy, is just to really speak to the needs and to not just speak about, but to figure out how we can address them together and to take leadership from those that have these needs.
There's a lot of stuff on the table, but there are two things that I really want to see followed up on. One, Lester, you were talking about basically how we've shifted the dialogue in the country, but we haven't shifted, this is something that folks don't seem to talk about much, we haven't shifted any policy. So what does that happen? We're in a massive electoral cycle. What does it mean for this autonomous, nonpartisan, non-electoral movement to have emerged in this cycle, in this moment? And we're obviously very directly attached to this moment. So what does it mean for us to be acting right now when there really is systemic crisis and there needs to be systemic solutions, but we're not engaging in many ways the actors that are going to be influencing the most immediate policy things? So where does rubber hit the road there, and how does that policy transition? How do we influence it? I often view it as kind of being magnetic poles, where we, for the last 30 years, we've had this huge pole pulling the country to the right because there hasn't been any pole on the left. So now there's a left, but we're incredibly immature, you know? So where does that go? And then something that John said that I'd like to see a little bit more discussion of is, now we've been sitting on this 99% meme for 2.5 months plus. Like, what does that mean? That's been problematic from the beginning. Like, there's no differentiation. Something that Molly could talk about, this coming week in D.C., there's a whole week of actions. It's organized by labor unions, it's organized by Occupy, it's organized by Move On. And there are a bunch of large electoral, long-standing organizations that have signed on to the occupation movement, that have latched on to, we're all the 99%, and we are all the 99%, but we're not all the same people, and we don't all have the same tactics, we don't all have the same goals, we don't all interact with the state in the same way, we don't all interact with each other in the same way. We have vertical organizations, we have horizontal organizations. So what there's a threat, amongst other things, there's a threat of co-optation. So there's a threat of co-optation as a result of the 99% meme being such a big, broad umbrella. But there's also, like, there's another part of it that I think is really important, which is, as I've been reading, like, the census data that the New York Times reported, there's also another level. There's a 33%. That's the 1/3 of all Americans that are either in or near poverty. So, like, this is 1/3 of the U.S. population that's in danger with one minor crisis of slipping into poverty. So, like, what is that third, and how does that relate to the 99%, and how does that relate to the Occupy movement?
Thank you for those questions. I want to go back a bit and then take both of those. First, when I critique, when I made the claims about proliferation, I was engaging in a critique, but I wasn't making a claim that we should go to them or that they should come to us. As far as I'm concerned, and I'm going to complicate this a bit, as far as I'm concerned, there's only us, right? And my whole point was that as soon as you start thinking of yourself as Occupy at McKeldin Square, that isn't, and that thing becomes crystallized, then it becomes a them and us. And then it becomes, okay, are they going to come to us or are we going to go to them? My whole thing was that Occupy was kind of a label that was associated with tactics. It wasn't an organization. It was a label and it was tactics. A software geek writing for The Atlantic made the argument that Occupy was like an API, right? It was like a web app, right? And granted, that language has some problems, but I think that's right. And the further we move away from that, the more it makes it difficult for us to organize and to proliferate and to swarm, and the easier it is for somebody to come and stamp us out. That's the first thing. Now, as to the questions, right? One of you made the comment that we need to be engaging in politics on all sides. I know what you meant by that, but I would articulate that a different way. There's only one side. There's the right side. Now, what I would say, now this is me straight up being a hardcore political scientist, there may be some of us that are worth running for office and supporting, right? I met one guy, right? But besides that, it's about fighting for issues, right? Fighting for issues. Even 5 years ago, George Bush, as conservative as he was, couldn't get Social Security changed because he couldn't get his conservative Republican House members to support it because there was now consensus around Social Security, and that speaks to the war of maneuver, war of position. So it's about us engaging in politics directly, not through saying we're going to vote for Obama or we're going to vote for X. It's about saying these are the issues and being incredibly disruptive and productive until those issues come forth. And then I'd like to leave the second question to you. There's one thing I think we need to do that Occupy hasn't done effectively, separate from my other critique, is we've got a great deal of cultural capital in the form of music, in the form of images, in the form of theater that I think we can easily deploy during the winter term, using stuff like YouTube, using stuff like DVDs, using CDs, that can increase, that can build capital, that can organize or get people to think about their lives in a different way, and then to also fight against this media thing that makes it seem like we don't exist. I'll leave the second question to my man.
Now, what was the second question?
The
99%. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I think we need to be prepared to evolve the metaphors. We need to be prepared to evolve the stories, to change the narratives. You know, this 99% thing, it worked really well, right? But I do think we need to sort of push on it a little bit, and we need to figure out where else we can push, right? Where else we can act in such a way that'll galvanize as much support, but that will draw attention to different parts of the puzzle here, right? You know, the focus on Wall Street, the focus on the commanding heights of finance is useful, but it's also very dangerous. And I think we need to figure out, you know, especially as we talk about moving forward and bringing more people in, how to sort of diversify this message. And I think that's something we've tried to do a little bit in Baltimore with some of the development stuff. And there's a lot of potential for some really big coalitions in Baltimore around that stuff, which is exciting. And there's people who have been organizing for, you know, long periods of time, some people in the government, some people outside of the government, you know, some people coming from an academic sort of activist background, some people coming from a very community activist background. And I think kind of figuring out how to knit those sort of coalitions together, right? Around specific narratives. And they're narratives that can be easy to understand. They're narratives that can galvanize support. They're narratives that can have the simplicity of the 99 versus the 1%. And certainly that's a real problem, right? I mean, you look at, it's not a manufactured, you know, kind of rhetorical device, right? I mean, there's a Citibank report from, I want to say 2000, actually I'm not sure when the year was, but there's a Citibank report that talks about plutonomy, right? Comes up with this term to describe the fact that the, you know, the divergence in wealth is growing to unprecedented heights, right? And this first, you know, the first work being done on this is actually being done by bankers who are looking at this and being like, wow, we're actually splitting into two very distinct economies, right? We have an economy at the top and we have an economy of all the rest. And this is historically unprecedented, right? And has the potential for a lot of backlash. So that's real, right? The 99 and the 1% is a real thing. It's not just a rhetorical thing, but it's not the end of the story. And that's, I think, where, you know, what's the next chapter in this story? That's the challenge for the spring, right? We come back in the spring and we're like, all right, 99-1, you know, it's not going to take people to that next step. It's not going to build the kinds of coalitions we need to build in order to actually address all the dimensions of the crisis that we're facing.
I'd like to hear, Molly, can you talk a little bit about Occupy from that ally perspective? And, like, looking at this week of action that you have coming up and what has been the discussion that you've heard about how Occupy reinforces your work and how you can reinforce Occupy's work? And I'd also like, Joy, if you'd be willing to share a little bit about what your work has been going around knocking on doors and, like, what your interactions have been like as you've been going and doing cold calls on doors about Occupy Baltimore in Baltimore. And then we'll go to discussion. I'd love it if folks can think, I'm thinking for the discussion, it would probably be richest if we did break up into, if we divided up into small groups for like 20 minutes, so that the maximum number of people can speak, because I'm sure a lot of folks have a lot of stuff on their mind, then come back together for another 20, 25 minutes and do a go-around. Hear what people are saying and have a little more discussion. So I haven't come up with a list of what I want those small groups to be. We could just divide up and randomly, or we could divide up thematically, but I don't have a list of those themes. I have a list of a bunch of stuff. And before we go into that, there's Tim from D.C., not right now, but in a second, Tim from Occupy D.C. that wanted to give a message from Occupy D.C.
Okay, I'm trying to think of what I want to say about this. First, let me plug, you mentioned the next week's events in D.C. The SEIU and I believe some other labor unions working very closely with Occupy movements throughout the country and Occupy D.C. are going to converge on the Capitol for a week of action, Tuesday through Thursday. If anyone's interested in more details, please come speak to me afterwards. But I think from an ally perspective, looking at the Occupy movement, I think it would be most helpful if people just think of this word that I know we all use a lot as occupiers and, of course, in the labor movement, which is solidarity. And just really developing what solidarity means at a community level, how we relate to one another and keeping positive and looking out for one another, just whether it's in the camp, in our homes, within our circles, and then taking that to a broader scope and, again, building these coalitions, because it's been mentioned many times, but there are so many people doing good work in this city and in this country, and if we can show solidarity with each other for common causes, which we all know exist between us, that is going to be our biggest strength. People are already working and having great successes, but need the many, many voices behind them in order to make those struggles come to fruition. So I think it's something we all know, but just want to, you know, reiterate and really think about, you know, what that word means in our individual lives and for the movement in general. Was there another question? Is there something I'm missing here? Okay.
Okay, the reason this is brought up as a question as far as like how it is received when we either knock on doors or approach people in the street about the movement is because I work with Outreach Direct Action, as I said earlier. I personally actually don't feel comfortable knocking on doors yet. I'm not at that level. There are a lot of people that do that. I do usually approach people in the street. Today we actually went to Waverly Farmers Market and talked to a lot of individuals. It's very strange because people will outright tell you, especially if they are coming from a very comfortable space, whether they support or don't support it. If you've been down to McKeldin, or some of you I know have slept down at McKeldin, you know people are also very vocal. It is very surprising that people will spend about a half an hour talking with you about what they don't or do not like, and they're willing to hear you. So I think one of the greatest points about going canvassing in the neighborhood, and I would encourage more people to come join us or go on your own canvassing trip about the movement as a whole, because the dialogue that happens is very rich. whether they agree or disagree with you. And the people that do agree generally sign, we have a canvassing sheet, and they usually sign their name up and say they want to volunteer. Some people that disagree, by the end of the conversation, we come to some sort of, not agreement, but a very peaceful end to the conversation. Some people kind of play up what is happening in the media, and they refuse kind of any sort of critique I have of the media, because they, even though they might say, I don't usually watch Fox News, but they said this and that about the movement. You can kind of tell that people have a very sort of, and I think we're noticing this if we've been involved in any sort of Occupy or even some sort of activism, which I'm very new to, by the way. I think I'm the only one on the panel, actually, that hasn't been involved in activism before this. But that they lean very heavy on what is very comfortable and what has been very comfortable for them up until this point. As someone mentioned before, this is very new. This is 2 months old. So trying to convince someone that what we're doing, if they didn't already agree, is not something that we try to do when we go canvassing. We just want to hear their stories. We want to hear where they're coming from. We also encourage critiques as far as what we can do better. Those are always fun. So, okay. All right.
Tim? As Tim's approaching, like, one more thing that's really fascinating to me is that, you know, all social movements are also cultural movements. And one of the most interesting cultural artifacts that I've experienced coming out of this is that folks, we're kind of saturating society with a horizontal form of communication. We did a mock general assembly down at the site for a bunch of homeschooled, largely Muslim kids. And there was this 10-year-old named Zaid, who apparently has been, in order to get his parents' attention, has been calling out mic check from his bedroom. And he got thrown out of his Boy Scout troop because, unbeknownst to him, the scout leader was a banker, and he had all of his co-scouts yelling, "Banks got bailed out, we got sold out." So, like, interestingly, we're not really a musical movement, but there's this cultural saturation that's going on that's reaching people in ways that you wouldn't know. Like, I had no idea until I was talking to them. I was like, really?